Good morning. Welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. My name is Linda Lair, and I serve as the Vice President of the Board of Trustees. Child care is available during the service in the nursery in the lower level of Fellowship Hall, which can be reached by walking through either level of the connector building and then taking the elevator or stairs to the lower level. If the need arises any time during the service, please feel free to take your child there where he or she will be well cared for. If you're not sure where to go, one of the ushers will guide you. Everyone is invited to coffee hour in Fellowship Hall after the service. To get there, please exit the church through the doors to my left, follow the hallway to the end. You can take the stairs or the elevator and follow the arrow to Fellowship Hall. If this is your first time with us, we are very happy to have you here. Please sign one of our guest books, which are located in the vestibule at the front of the entrance of the church or the new entrance or at the visitor's table and coffee hour so we can put you on our mailing list.
Thank you, Linda, and it's my privilege to welcome our guest preacher, who is the Reverend Mary Margaret Earle. She's the senior minister and executive director of Our Urban Ministry. And I say our because we are one of the 50-member congregations that that supports that organization. So it's great to have you here, and you'll hear from her throughout the service. It's also wonderful to greet all of you. And as we do it, this service community is so important to us that we begin this service with an opportunity to greet your neighbor. So please reach out, and particularly reach out to anyone who may be new and visiting with us today, and welcome them, invite them to coffee. Welcome and peace to you. We come to this time and this place to rediscover the wondrous gift of free religious community, to renew our faith in the holiness, goodness, and beauty of life, to reaffirm the way of the open mind and the full heart, to rekindle the flame of memory and hope, and to reclaim the vision of an earth made fair and all her people one. As we light our chalice, and Mike, would you light the chalice for us, please? I invite you to join in the words of chalice lighting printed in your order of service. The abundance of this place, the faith of its people, its songs of compassion and justice and joy, these will be our wholeness and wisdom. These will be our light, a light that welcomes all who seek a spiritual home, a light that shines as a beacon of hope, a light we bring from this place to meet the challenges of our times. Please be seated and attentive to a message for all ages from our guest minister today.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Good morning. I'm going to tell a story, and I need your help in telling this story because it involves me trying to pretend that I'm a choral conductor, which I am not, and I know two sort of choir directory gestures. One is this, which is when I'm going to ask you to sing with the pace at which my hand moves. So if I move like this, you go fast, and if I go like this, you go slow. That's one. And the other, my last piece of choir conductor knowledge is that when you go like this, it means stop. So I want to tell a story about frogs, a whole country of frogs. And this country of frogs lived in a swampy area where there was lots of water and things to hop on, and there were trees dripping with moss. And the frogs really enjoyed their lives. And I wonder if you could imagine some of the things that frogs liked to do in their day-to-day lives in the swamp. What kinds of things do frogs, what makes frogs happy? Bugs, eating bugs. What else might make a frog in a swamp happy? You're cutting to the chase. Sing, yes, but wait, hold that thought. What else would a frog like to do? Swim. Jump. Yes. So they had lives that were full of eating bugs and swimming and jumping. And even though that was a wonderful life, they thought they would also like to start a chorus and sing. There was one problem, though, with the frogs of the swamp. They all had high voices. That's it, just high voices. And so I'm going to ask this side of the room to be our swamp frogs. And the swamp frogs all sounded like this. La, 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 la. Thank you. Very good. And it sounded pretty good. And they got together again, and they decided to keep trying to sing together. So they sang fast and they sang slow like this, but always with the same high voice. And it was pretty nice, but still a little one-dimensional. And one day, as they were practicing to form their frog chorus, the wind blew over the mountain that was near them, and it brought with them the songs of other frogs singing, and these were the songs of the mountain frogs. And these frogs also liked to sing, and they had a challenge because they all had low voices, and they all sounded like this, low, 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 low. And they tried to mix it up. Again, a little one-dimensional. So when the swamp frogs heard the sound of low voices coming over the mountain, they thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have a chorus with many voices? But there was the challenge of the mountain stood in their way. So they got together to kind of figure out how would they get together with the mountain frogs. Any ideas for how the swamp frogs could get to the mountain frogs with the mountain between them? Leapfrog. Very good. Left one after each other. What are some of the other ways they might try to deal with the mountain? Skype. Skyping. Any other ideas? Call in a demolition expert. Oh, they could. They could build a tunnel through. Maybe climb up and over. All kinds of ways that you could kind of try to tackle that thing that's between you. So they did all those things. They climbed and dug and Skyped, and somehow they got together with the mountain frogs, and they decided to start to sing together, and this is what it sounded like. And they still had a journey ahead of them to really forming a true chorus, and they needed to practice. But what they realized was that they had, when they were together, all the voices that they needed to make a really rich and beautiful sound, and learned how important it was to try to scale that distance between them. So thank you for your help and for helping me pretend that I'm a choral leader for a moment.
Thank you, Mary Margaret. And like all stories, we take them home for to see what they mean for us for as people. So maybe this week you can think about how people are like frogs, and maybe also think about what the mountains are that might be in between us that keep us from making beautiful music together. We come into a time now of silent prayer and meditation with these words of invitation from the Reverend Earl Holt. The moment of prayer is an invitation to be calm in the midst of the tumult of the world and our overbusy lives, to bring together thought and feeling, mind and spirit, and to find some center, some still point of perspective and peace. Here in this sanctuary, which has been the home for so many secret thoughts and hopes, fears and desires, may we feel free to look at ourselves with true honesty. May we be unafraid to face the decisions we have been trying to avoid, the doubts and questions it has been easier to ignore, the things we have tried to keep hidden not only from others, but even from ourselves. May we come to discover that there are resources within ourselves and beyond us that are as hidden but as real as the secret doubts and fears. New dimensions of the spirit within and without will be revealed to us as we confront ourselves honestly and come to understand that we are not isolated from the community of life and spirit, but that our soul's suffering connects us with the hidden sufferings of others. May we come to see in our deepest loneliness that we are not alone. And may we be emboldened by this vision to reach out to others in their need, and so finally to discover that to give is not only more blessed than to receive, but that to give to others is to receive what we most need for ourselves. Amen. Each week in our service, we provide you with an opportunity for generosity. And that is generosity not only to this church, but also to another worthy local, national, or international charity with which we are splitting our plate, our offering for each month. And this month, it is the Unitarian Universalist Urban Ministry. As I said before, our urban ministry, we have a special relationship with this organization because we, in fact, are one of its sponsors. We are one of the member, about 50 member congregations who for years have supported these wonderful programs. These programs include, as you'll hear more from Mary Margaret later, academic and enrichment programs for children and youth after school in Roxbury, shelter for individuals who are experiencing domestic violence, not just women, but we're one of the few shelters who also shelters gay, bisexual, transgender individuals who've been victims of abusive relationships, affordable housing for women in the Boston community and an intentional community, volunteer capacity building for organizations in Roxbury, and more. It's a wonderful organization. I serve on the board and have for many years, and this church has served not only with its financial support, but last Tuesday we went in and presented a dinner for about 70 people before a forum there. Next Saturday, as Linda mentioned, we'll be going in and volunteering to help with the Explorers Club. And again, if you're free on Saturday and have some crafting, gaming, or singing skills, Lisa Martino will be leading the singing, and I know she'd love to have a few others along with her for that. We'd love to have you go with us. And also, there's other opportunities as well. So, the morning offering will be now gratefully accepted, and your generosity both for the work of this church and the work of the urban ministry is deeply appreciated. Ubi caritas et amor.
reading is from the book My Grandfather's Blessings by the physician Rachel Naomi Remen. Many times when we help, we do not really serve. Those who help see life differently from those who serve and may affect life differently as well. It is hard not to see the person you are helping as someone weaker than yourself, someone more needy. When we help, we become aware of our strength because we are using it. Others become aware of our strength as well and may feel diminished by it. But we do not serve with our strength. We serve with ourselves. We draw from all our experiences. Over the years, I have discovered that everything I know serves, and everything I am serves. I have served people impeccably with parts of myself that embarrass me, parts of which I am ashamed. The wholeness in me serves the wholeness in others and the wholeness in life. The wholeness in you is as worthy as the wholeness in me. Service is a relationship between equals. So ends the reading. I wanted to add to Reverend Rossiello's comments about Stowe and Acton's engagement with the urban ministry that last Tuesday some of you came and provided a wonderful dinner for our pre-forum dinner together, and you set a very high bar for the other two churches that have to follow you for the next two Tuesdays. So thank you, and thank you for sharing also Tom's time with us. He's a wonderful member of our board, and we're really grateful that he serves the urban ministry. Last summer, I met a dear colleague at a Providence, Rhode Island coffee shop for croissant and catching up. We have a lot in common, including a shared commitment to social justice and a deep faith. One difference is plain. I am white, she is African American. This day, we talked about our different work to confront racism. We talked about what's broken and what needs to be healed. And she told me that she has a particular task for herself in the year ahead, to try to open herself up to trusting more people who are white. And here we entered a moment that was both sacred and hard. Sacred in her naming an intimate struggle in her sharing this with me, and hard to face the reality of the space between us. She is a woman whom I know to be widely revered and loved by many people across race, culture, and class, and there is no one kinder, warmer, more generous to all than she. But there is a place in her heart that is wary, and that breaks mine. I am not surprised, nor should I be, if there is a particular issue that surfaced in 2015. It was the gulf in perception and experience between African Americans and whites across the United States. Perceptions and experiences about power structures like police and courts and the reality of racism. As the Black Lives Matter movement rose from the deaths of men like Eric Garner and Michael Brown, so did opposition. My morning Facebook feed scrolls through comments on the Black Lives Matter movement, giving me a glimpse of the divide. My Facebook friends include classmates from the all-white farming community where I grew up. Their comments about Blue Lives Matter show frustration with a movement they don't understand. But comments from progressive Unitarian Universalists highlight the divide, too. Our Unitarian Universalist Association stands in support of the Black Lives Matter movement, and I see white UUs struggle to understand. UUs who say, of course, they oppose racism, but shouldn't church banners say all lives matter because our faith embraces the inherent dignity of all of us? In such resistance lies not ill will, but a failure to feel, see, and hear what African Americans are expressing about their lived experience. an experience that is different from mine, from that of other white people. That resistance to listening is a barrier to building relationships, to building trust, and working side by side across our differences to make the world more just. That resistance is a barrier to healing racism. I cannot imagine that African Americans want to spend time persuading white people of the reality of racism any more than I want to spend time persuading men on my lived experience of sexism, or a gay person wants to persuade straight people on the reality of homophobia, or someone with a disability wants to convince the able-bodied that the world really is harder when you're in a wheelchair. The African-American writer John Mehta last June preached at an all-white church about racism, reluctantly. He wrote, "You see, I don't talk about race with white people. To illustrate why, I'll tell a story. It was probably about 15 years ago when a conversation took place between my aunt, who is white and lives in New York State, and my sister, who is black, and lives in North Carolina. This conversation can be distilled to a single sentence said by my black sister. She said, 'The only difference between people in the North and people in the South is that down here, at least people are honest about being racist.' He said, 'Over a decade later, my aunt is still hurt by the suggestion that people in New York, that she, a northerner, a liberal, a good person who has black family members, is a racist.' He said, 'To my aunt, the suggestion that people in the North are racist is an attack on her as a racist. She is unable to differentiate her participation within a racist system from an accusation that she individually is a racist. Without being able to make that differentiation,' he said, 'white people in general decide to vigorously defend their own personal non-racism or point out that it doesn't exist because they don't see it.'" And so John Mehta tries not to talk about race, a defining aspect of his identity, with white people. There is a wall between us. I felt this wall most keenly 20 years ago, during my previous career in journalism. I worked at the Syracuse, New York newspapers, and the reporter in the next cubicle was an African-American woman writer. Our proximity meant we talked daily, and talking led to cooperating on stories, to humor and sharing, and the day-to-dayness of our relationship made us close. Or pretty close. Our proximity brought me into the orbit of the other African-American journalists who were her friends. Our proximity meant I was gifted with being part of a conversation that I might otherwise not have heard, and it taught me at least a little about differences in perception based on our experiences. It was during this period that I had a spiritual conversion that transformed my agnosticism into a panentheism in which I perceived God in everything and everything within the body of God, all people, the earth, and animals too. My awareness of the suffering of animals led me to becoming a vegan and an animal rights activist. And for this, I was almost fired. I was a feature writer at the time, and I was assigned a cooking story about preparing veal. I asked the editors to be assigned to another story. I suggested alternative stories. My African-American colleague offered to write the story instead. Finally, a managing editor, white, called me into his office, and he said, "Enough. You'll either say yes, you'll write the story, this story, or it's no, and you'll be fired, or we'll begin laying the path to firing you." I looked him in the eyes, and I said no. It was terrifying and freeing and fascinating, too, in what I learned about myself and my newsroom colleagues. I had many newsroom friends, but this is what I remember. As the top editor stewed over my fate, nearly all my white colleagues quietly stepped away. I do not recall a peep of support except from one woman who really loved dogs. But three African-American women, none of whom could relate to my animal rights cause at all, approached me, ready to stand with me. They became my support system in those hard days. And I saw firsthand the difference in the way my white colleagues and African-American colleagues viewed the newspaper authorities. These three women didn't assume that because those in power found me at fault, that it meant I was wrong. They knew firsthand that power is not inherently just, and their inclination was for the underdog. I wasn't fired. I was relegated to a suburban bureau where I worked until leaving for seminary. My friendship with these strong women remained. But much as they supported me and welcomed me, much as I loved them, they ultimately had a bond with one another that I couldn't share. Perhaps because their mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers had experienced the pain of racism that I could not know. Perhaps they were not certain that I could listen to their experience of racism without justifying or defending or disbelieving. Perhaps they couldn't talk freely about their anger. They connected with one another and were intimate in ways that I knew I was outside of. I was always a step outside of that inner circle of sisterhood. And my love and respect for them, and the knowledge that it is racism, the racism into which we were all born, that kept us separate, breaks my heart still. The guarded heart of my new colleague in Providence breaks my heart still. And it is the love that I have for these women and the pain of the separation between me and brothers and sisters who are African American, this love and pain that opens me up to the task before us at the Unitarian Universalist Urban Ministry. The greater Boston area, like many urban areas, is divided by race, class, and faith. According to the U.S. 2010 Census Project, among the nation's large cities, Boston ranks 11th most segregated between blacks and whites and fourth in Hispanic-white segregation. The consequence of segregation is injustice. Minorities living in Boston's segregated neighborhoods make less money, suffer poorer health, lack access to jobs, quality housing, and education, and experience greater violence compared with peers living in whiter neighborhoods. The impact of segregation also results in harder to measure damage between groups, estrangement, mistrust, and fear, which leads to more entrenched segregation. And here is where the UU Urban Ministry stands. After a decade of ministry in Providence, Rhode Island, within the homeless community, I arrived at the UU Urban Ministry a little over a year ago. The Urban Ministry is one of the country's oldest social services agencies, comprised of 50 UU congregations like Stowe and Acton, grounded in UU values and positioned in the heart of Boston's historic African-American community. Over the 185 years of its existence, it has provided heating fuel for the poor, created elderly housing, built a child care center, opened an Asian-American food pantry. The goal always has been serving, but also bringing people together across the divide. In 2016, our core programs, as Tom mentioned, include our domestic violence shelter, which also supports male and gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered survivors, too, our youth program, which nurtures, tutors, and feeds young people after school, our housing program, our capacity building program, and our Explorers Enrichment program. But we also seek to create a diverse community through social events like jazz concerts and ice cream socials, for UU's and Roxbury neighbors. We are transforming our campus, our historic First Church, our education center, chapel, and grounds, into a community hub that welcomes neighborhood and social justice groups for meetings, retreats, worship, and celebration. We are planning and hosting forums that highlight the social challenges of our times, like our event on Tuesday on environmental racism. We warmly invite you to join us at that event. What ties all of this together is an acknowledgement of the importance of relationship as a catalyst for change. What ties our work together is a desire to create relationships grounded in respect, a desire not to be a UU charity in Roxbury, but an agency built on UU values and committed to social engagement as a way of working for justice. We are striving to build mutuality across the differences of race, class, and experience in our committees, staff, and board. We are striving to build up trust and bring down the walls between us. This is not a simple agenda and not accomplished in a straight march to progress. Recently, as I prepared to preach, I spoke with a longtime UU volunteer who tutors in our youth program. As a child, she attended an all-white boarding school, lives in a white suburb, witnesses the segregation of her own life. Over her time at the Urban Ministry, she has come to see her work as not some kind of noblesse oblige, but as a call to be in relationship with people who are different from her and to learn. She said, "I am receiving more than I am helping." Sometimes her learning has been awkward and uncomfortable. Her engagement with people across difference has taught her she needs to step back and let others lead. She has learned she needs to keep listening. And she has been cracked open by her experience, cracked open to the educational injustice in Boston, cracked open to the reality of the lives of young people in Roxbury. She sees headlines about shootings in Roxbury differently now. She said, "I'm angry. I'm a little guilty. There are a lot of things I don't know. It's not sorted out, but I think it's the right thing to be there. It is messy and imperfect work, and we haven't arrived, but we are trying." The Jewish mystical tradition, the Kabbalah, describes creation this way: God poured God's self into a vessel too small to contain him. The vessel shattered into a million pieces, and our role is to repair what is broken. The human family has been shattered too, by slavery and war and greed and fear, by racism and sexism. Our task as a religious people is to heal what is broken, to find ways of weaving us all back into one human family, to commit to our UU principles of seeking justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. In the great paradox of life, our task is to be willing to be broken in order to heal our brokenness. We must be willing to be broken open by the pain of racism and injustice to really begin healing it, to heal it within ourselves, and within our social, educational, economic, housing, and legal systems. To be heartbroken by love and by grief, to be cracked open to the reality of prison and poverty and violence and trauma, to be heartbroken by the walls that divide us in order to bring them tumbling down. It is not easy work, it is not comfortable work, and its success is not assured. I am not inviting you to join the work of the UU Urban Ministry because we have the answer or because we have a shortcut to the answer. I'm not inviting you to come because it will always feel good, because sometimes it won't. Working across difference, trying to build real relationships, isn't simple. But I am inviting you to a place where we are trying to build bridges, to learn, to witness, to stand in hope of change. I am inviting you to be like me, broken, wide open, to let real love in. May you be blessed on your work. May we be blessed in ours, and may we find ways of weaving our paths together. Amen.